I'm riding a bicycle with this song.
One of those ones with the big
trolley.
I forget what those are called.
Well, this is if it's Sunday, it's the main course.
I'm Katie Kiefer.
I'm Patrick Martins.
And this is the Heritage Radio Network. Today's show is sponsored by Hearst Ranch. Thank you, Hearst.
That is, guys, we now have a producer mic, which is amazing. Guys, are you there?
Hello.
Wow, that's the first time ever. So, hey, Jack, who's our producer, Jack Inslee, I'm going to do a Hearst sponsor drop. Are you guys ready back there?
Hold on. Let us get ready.
Okay, Nat Wiener, our engineer, are you ready for the Hearst drop?
And I'm ready.
I'll be sad to not hear that music, but hold on.
You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Today's program was brought to you by Hearst Ranch. www.hearstranch.com.
Who is that guy?
I don't know, but oh my God, you guys aren't going to shut up now. You guys have all that comedy things going on. Listen, now that we can talk to you, Katie's mic isn't working.
No, I don't know if my mic is working, but my headphones certainly aren't.
I'm sorry, Katie, could you talk closer to the mic?
I'm talking as close as I want to, honey.
I can't hear you.
Can you play a slide whistle on our behalf?
Uh-oh.
As long as they can hear me out there, I don't care if you can hear me in here.
So, no, we can hear you. The world can hear you.
Well, Pat, we have a great show today. We have Ann Cooper, who is the... thank you very much, Nat. Ann Cooper is the renegade... She's called the renegade lunch lady.
She gets stuff done.
She does get stuff done. It took her a while, but she has definitely moved the needle towards better nutrition in the school system, and she's going to join us today.
It's taken her a while.
It has, but you know, it's a behemoth of an organization to move, and I can't believe how she has stuck to her guns with this.
Behemoth organizations must rely on strategies. Every decision they make is a strategic thing, and even moving one notch on the needle takes years.
It does.
Whereas someone like Anne, relies on the tactics of a one-person show. She can go to a city like Denver and actually change the lunch program. Just one individual mobilizing a movement. You know, it's not terrorists, but, you know, it's using the same tactics. It's an individual coming into a big behemoth and changing it. It's really admirable.
She is totally admirable. She is the author of several books, and she has gone from Bridgehampton to Berkeley to now Denver, I understand, and she's doing her good work there. So she'll be on in a few minutes to tell us about her program with Whole Foods. She has partnered up with them, and that's one of the reasons why I think she's likely to be, you know, more successful, reach more people than she has been in the past, because she'll have a little greater visibility. I know, isn't that cool? And then the other person we have in the studio today is Andrew Smith.
Yeah, he's right here, actually. Hey, right, Andrew.
Here. Hi, Peter. Hi, Katie.
Patrick is
oh,
my name.
Oh, Patrick. My name is, my mind is not doing well here.
That's
I've been
so
drinking
nervous,
samosas. So that's my problem.
Someone with a great face for radio like Andy, I'm surprised he started off on the right foot.
Anyway, Andy is with us. He is a food historian, besides being a professor at the New School for Social Research. Mm-hmm. And he is going to be talking to us about his new book, Eating History, 30 Turning Points in the Making of American Cuisine. So that'll be coming up right after Ann Cooper.
Radio, if ever there's an addendum, like radio, Heritage Radio Network and Heritage Foods might be number 31 or 32. But we can talk about that later.
Okay.
So certainly helping spread the gospel here with these shows.
Doing our best.
HRN now, I think, has 3 or 4 new shows, including one by Bernie Wides, who's actually Erica Wides' father. Erica Wides is the host of Why We Cook, which airs on Mondays. And he is, I guess, a very important person at the Natural History Museum in the mollusk and butterfly department.
Well, I'm very excited to hear his program. I think that's going to be great.
Yeah,
I love that we're opening up to new shows and different disciplines. I think that's terrific.
Guys,
the natural world is a
big deal.
You got
Ann on the line.
Hello, Ann Cooper. This is Katie Kiefer and Patrick Martins. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for joining us today. I'm totally thrilled to have you on the show and totally excited to talk to you about your program with Whole Foods. But I want to give listeners who may, incredibly enough, not be familiar with you a little background. So if you can just kind of give us an overview of your extraordinary efforts to improve nutrition in the school system in the United States over the last, it's got to be 15 years now, right? Or is it more?
It actually feels like a lifetime, but really it's only been a little bit more than 10. So I've been working on these issues, specifically around children, sustainability and, you know, chefs and food. I've been doing that for my whole career. But as far as kids, it's really been 10 years. I started in a private school in New York and then ended up doing some work in Harlem and New York City. And then in fall of 04, Alice Waters asked me to come join her team working out in Berkeley. I eventually became the director of nutrition services in Berkeley, and then I most recently became the director of nutrition services in Boulder, Colorado. And along the way, I started a foundation, and the foundation's the Food Family Farming Foundation. We're building a web portal, and that's the work I'm doing with Whole Foods.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Well, and this is Patrick. So tell us from the very beginning. So what was the school in Manhattan? Was it the Calhoun School?
Well, no, actually, Chef Bobo did come out to the Ross School. It was the Ross School in East Hampton, New York.
Oh, East Hampton, New York, exactly, that one. I thought there was a New York City one before. So,
there was a New York City school that I worked on, and that was Promise Academy in Harlem.
Uh-huh.
And that was the school I worked on in New York.
And what exactly were you hired for when you went to the new school? What was your, you know, mission and your job description?
So it was the Ross School, and what I was asked to do when I first went there is was to really look at what it would be like in a perfect world. What would we feed kids and teach them about food? And we came up with a program, Regional Organic Seasonal Sustainable, and that's how we fed kids and what we taught them about food. And it was multi-generational, and there was no food allowed in from the outside. And the program still exists today. It was really the stepping stone that helped us develop programs for public schools across the country.
And how did you get offered that? I mean, what had you studied before? And I mean, that seems like a very tall order, and you accomplished it. So, I mean, how did you get that job?
Well, they asked me. So I basically took a phone call one day, and I was asked to become the director of wellness and nutrition, basically, a.k.a. a lunch lady. And I literally looked at the phone, Patrick, and went, what, me, lunch lady? I mean, you know, it's sort of been this white tablecloth celebrity chef. I'd worked all over this country, overseas, on cruise ships, hotels, backstage for big music events, backstage for the dead. I mean, you know, that was the kind of stuff I did. And then to think of myself going into schools, but, you know, all of a sudden, I'd written this book, Bitter Harvest, and I really was thinking a lot about the food supply and why food makes us sick and who owns the food supply. And all of a sudden, it was just like light dawning, as if I was in a comic book, you know, a little light dawning over my head going, wow, I really maybe could give back and make a difference, and maybe I'm in a place in time where myself and all the people I work with could really do something to help kids all across the country. And I think now, 10 years later, we really are.
What do you think is coming up soon, I know, is the renewal of the Child Nutrition Act, and maybe we can talk a little bit about what that's going to mean for programs like yours.
Well, it's hard to know. It actually is supposed to be reauthorized in September before Tom Harkin changed from Ag to Health, head of the Ag Committee to head of the Health Committee. He said he wasn't going to bring it forward until the end of the calendar year or beginning of next year. Now that he's not even there, and given where we are in healthcare, I can't imagine that we're going to really hear too much about it till January. Potentially, it could mean everything. In actuality, given the healthcare debate and given the contentiousness around even fixing something that we need so badly as healthcare for all people, it's hard for me to imagine that we really will see significant differences this year. However, I've recently met with Kathleen Merrigan, Deputy Secretary of Ag, and also Arnie Duncan, Secretary of Education, his chief of staff and wife in Washington. And through both of those meetings, it seems really clear that both the Secretary of Education and the Secretary of Agriculture both know, understand, and care about changing what we feed kids in schools. But that's a long way away from actually having the government make those changes, although I am optimistic.
What are biggest challenges that face face you in terms of making those changes? Because the government and the public school system makes contracts with big food distributors, right? And then you're sort of stuck, first of all, with a very tiny budget. I think it's like 95 cents a kid. Is that right?
Well, okay, so there's a couple of different things. There's five issues that all school districts face: food, finance, facilities, human resources, and marketing.
Wait,
food,
say that one more time.
Food, finance, facilities, human resources, and marketing.
Uh-huh.
So food, where are we going to get it and make sure that it's healthy? And that plays into what you were saying about this junk food that comes out of the, you know, government commodity food program.
Right.
Finances, how are we going to pay for it? The government reimburses schools for free lunch kids. Those are at and kids living at below poverty, $2.70. But of that, two-thirds goes to payroll and overhead. So usually around $1 goes to food.
Right.
Even if you got more money, and I think we need to add $1 there, we can talk more about that, most schools don't have the facilities to cook anymore. So mm-hmm. whether it's regionally or in some fashion, we need cooking kitchens, so we need the government to allocate funds. But even if you find the food and pay for the food and have a way to cook the food, unless we can train people to actually make the food, I mean, for so long, school district lunch ladies have been serving chicken nuggets and corn dogs, so they don't have any, skills. They don't have the skills they need.
Right. Well, back in the day, chicken a la king, which might have been a bit more involved, was still my least favorite dish.
Oh, yeah. I thought school lunch was disgusting. And my daughter, when she entered the school system, 7 or 8 years ago, she literally cried at the idea of having to eat the food that was served in the cafeterias. And it was...
It's so funny that they cry now, because back in the day, you didn't really even think to make a change.
Yeah, we called it elephant scabs and you know what on a shingle. I mean, it was
But you didn't think you could change the system.
No.
I mean, you didn't even know how bad what you were eating was back in the early 1970s, for
right.
sure.
Or
I just didn't hear
the
people.
The 60s when I ate school lunch.
Students rise in ninth grade to change the food
Definitely
system.
Definitely not. You just
happen.
Left. Yeah. You left school and went and ate pizza. We actually have a food historian in the studio with us today, Andy Smith. And I wondered if Andy had any insight into one of the things. We have so much stuff to talk about, Anne. I hope you'll come back. But... food is disgusting as it is in the cafeterias now, was really, as Patrick and I have just observed, not that much better, although it may have looked a little better. It wasn't chicken nuggets, but it was, shit on a shingle. And I don't think it was all that much more nutritious even. So standpoint...
Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I'm just sort of like trying to trace an arc of, the whole school lunch program, which probably began, in the 50s. 40s or 50s?
Well, 50s for sure. But Anne, maybe earlier?
It was about 60 years ago. It was really...
Oh, 60,
it was,
wow.
The National School Lunch Program was started because when we were beginning World War II, there weren't enough recruits that were not malnourished.
Right.
So it was started as a national security thing. Now we're too fat to fight, so that's a different national security issue. But but it was originally national security because young men were so malnourished that they couldn't actually serve in the military, and that's how it all started. Mm.
Now, I wanted to ask a question just back to what you were saying earlier. Your goal, obviously, from what you just said, is to change policy. But do you use policy to change policy, or do you use kind of vigilante, deals with the principal that allows you to do certain things so that you can get into the nitty-gritty and therefore prove to the policymakers, what's right and what's wrong?
Well, the problem is that principals have very little authority and power in most of America's schools over the school lunch program because it is a national program that's federally funded.
Mm-hmm.
So in most cases, it's the director of nutrition services, and there's usually one per school district. And these are the people who are accountable to the USDA that oversees the program. So... In some cases, yeah. I mean, what we need is models, and I've sort of been that renegade lunch lady out there trying to showcase that there are models that will work. But if we're going to fix it on a national level so that every child gets healthy food every day in school, it has to happen from the USDA policy standpoint because they hold all the cards. They hold all the power, they hold all the money, and they're in charge of the commodity food program and also the guidelines. In today's school lunches, chicken nuggets, tater tots, chocolate milk, high fructose corn syrup, trans fats, popsicles, Pop-Tarts, and corn dogs are all allowed. That's crazy.
So I still don't, just for our listeners out there, I mean, really, the Heritage Radio Network is always interested in, like, the grammar of what people do and what they're about and what they, and their work, really. So, I mean, how do you go into a place like Denver? I mean, who finds out who you are, who flies you in, who sets the paradigm, how many schools do you work with? Like, give us the real, like, ad nauseum, like, 4 or 5 or 10 steps that go into changing a lunch program in a city like you have.
So I'm in Boulder. I was asked to come to Boulder and take over the district. I think for a district that wants to make changes, you have to have the support of the superintendent, the school board, and the community, and both in Berkeley and Boulder, all of those stars aligned. Mm-hmm. So in both cases, I was asked to come in and do it. And so for a school district to make these changes, and there are school districts all across the country that are starting to walk down that road. New York City has a chef now. There's a chef that's gone into Baltimore, a chef that's gone into New Haven. There's Portland, Oregon, and even in the state of Oregon, they're making some really great headway. So, but it really starts with a group of people, often concerned parents or advocates, right, or a nonprofit advocacy group that goes in and says, "What will it take to start making these changes?" And
what are those changes? Is it another dollar? I mean, through private funding, or is it making better use of the dollar that you have to spend on the food? I mean, what are the changes that you implement?
We really do need more money, and I'm advocating and lobbying, you know, the USDA for an extra dollar. I'd like to see that dollar allocated to fresh fruits, vegetables, and whole grains with a priority on regional procurement. I think we need that dollar. That said, school districts can make some positive change with the money they have if they're willing to really do a full assessment of how they're spending all of their money and every single penny that's being spent around food or every single penny that's being charged to the food department's budget, because oftentimes school districts will actually charge things to the nutrition services budget that shouldn't be there, and we've found that in every school district we've worked with. The changes that can be made, you know, with a lot of hard work are things like getting rid of all processed foods, getting rid of all competitive foods, putting in fresh fruits and vegetables, salad bars in every school, only whole grain bread products, serving organic and in many cases regional milk at lunch. So there's a lot of great stuff you can do. But it's hard work, and it takes a lot of expertise that a lot of school districts don't have. And one of the projects I'm working on now with Whole Foods is building a web portal. It's called thelunchbox.org. And part of the reason we're building this website, this web portal, is because a lot of the expertise, a lot of the things that school districts need, they just can't even afford to develop. So we're taking everything that we've ever developed, our team, plus best practices from all school districts across the country, putting them in the public domain, giving them away for free, putting them up on a site that's available to every one of the 14,000 school districts, so that schools all across the country can really start making these kind of changes.
Well, and parents can also see the lunchbox.org in the Whole Foods stores themselves, where they run video monitors. I was in the new Whole Foods on the Upper West Side, and I saw you there, Anne.
Great.
So parents can also get involved, and parents should be encouraged to get involved in these programs, because without the support of the parents, I think it's very hard for the school to demand those changes from the district. Am I right there?
Absolutely.
So if parents get involved, I know that, and actually coming up in another week or two, we have Bill Telepan here in New York City, who's been very active with a program called Wellness in the Schools. And he's addressing some of the problems that you described earlier about the training of personnel in lunch cafeterias, where they're so accustomed to just opening a bag, spreading stuff out on a sheet pan and putting it in the oven. And they really literally do not know how to make even the most basic things. So he's been implementing a whole training program, and he's got the French Culinary Institute students interning into school cafeterias. And then, you know, by that program is spreading out through New York, and I'm sure, you know, you must know Bill.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Andy, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, there's another serious problem. Having worked 30 years in the public schools for a variety of different capacities, it's not just the availability of food. It's also the need for an educational program with students, because I walk into school cafeterias and they are required in New York City, for instance, if apple is on the menu, they must put an apple on every single tray as it comes through. And if you go and look at the trash can, all those apples are thrown out. And so you look at the waste that's going on in the current system, and that's a real shame. And it's the kids don't want to eat the food that you put down there that even may be good. So you need an educational program to go along with
it. Or you need someone who can prepare the apple in three or four different ways. And so it's coming in the form of an apple sauce one day and another day an apple. You know, better chefs in the kitchen.
Sure.
But I did want to ask one question about meats. Heritage Foods, I don't know if you know, and you know,
yes,
after Love Slow Food, you know, we do 150 pigs a week, and you know, 10,000 turkeys come the holidays. And I wanted to know, is it different you know, when, fruits and vegetables versus how to get the meat in the sloppy Joe. I mean, do the same rules apply for the protein component of the menu?
The protein component of the menu is even more complicated than the produce component. And that's so. Because of the USDA commodity food program. You know, our tax dollars spend $43, $45 billion a year on this commodity price support system. And much of what is supported not only is corn and soy, which we don't eat, but also animal protein. And so, for instance, schools often have this quote-unquote free, it's far from free, but quote-unquote free food in the free food like hamburger meat, ground meat, chicken turkey,
nuggets are a perfect
pork.
Example, yeah. Because
Chicken nuggets can be part of that system, mm-hmm. and it's all sort of sent into the schools, and a lot of cheese products as well. And in and of themselves, these may not be bad products, but when there's so much of it's free mm-hmm. and most of it's not clean protein, I think it's a really bad system. So where you're developing, you know, supply side around this really great animal protein that's natural or organic and hormone and antibiotic-free, things like that, none of that exists in the school lunch programs in America. And schools that decide to go outside of the USDA to get their animal protein, it's very expensive. In Berkeley, we were able to do it. We got hamburger that, you know, from cows off of Hearst Ranch, uh-huh. and we had a great deal. And so that was wonderful. But most schools are serving the stuff that comes from the USDA, and it's really sure. the bottom of the barrel. It's the same meat that we see being pulled back because
yeah, recalled
it's
again and right. again and again because of contamination issues.
And one last question just on that same thing. I mean, what can you advise distributors in fruits and vegetables or in proteins regionally around the country? What advice would you give them? I mean, do you think they're going to get the call one day to start supplying food for the lunch program? And what can they do to prepare, be they in Minnesota or Oregon or Montana? Like, what can the distributors do to help your cause?
Well, the thing that distributors can do,
or the farmers,
or you know, anyone who's all producers. First of all, they have to really understand this thing about there's only a dollar. So they have to be willing to work at different margins and markups, which I think is often difficult. And the last thing I want to promote is farmers not getting a fair price. Mm-hmm. The reality is it's very difficult. But one of the things is a lot of the product could be what we might consider seconds, the stuff that's not good enough to sell at the farmers market or put in Whole Foods. That there's a lot of that kind of product out there that would work fine in schools. For instance, schools want very small-sized pieces of fruit, and those small-sized pieces of fruit do not work in farmers markets or grocery stores by and large. So that there's other ways we can think about this. For instance, you know, if you're in some kitchens that can do production, you know, is there a way to bring in tomatoes? And we did this in New York all summer long, make your tomato sauce and freeze it for the winter.
Right.
And how can we work together to get the food when it's the most delicious and also most financially viable into schools? And I think it takes a lot of discussion. We're going to have a whole bunch of tools around this whole procurement, regional procurement issues, up on the website, thelunchbox.org. But it's really about sitting down at the table and figuring out how your product, whatever that product is, get into schools. For instance, here in Boulder, we've got a local burrito company making our burritos for us. We're using Colorado milk. We've got a lot of local companies making product for us, but it really takes really sitting down and figuring out how to make it work.
And you still do all that with the dollar?
Well, we're at a little bit more than a dollar. We're at about $1.30. And
because of where you are, or because you've raised the money?
Neither, exactly. What we've done is we're betting the farm, if you will, on raising participation. The way you can start to make these programs really financially viable is by raising participation. So in Berkeley, when I got there, we were doing about 500,000 meals, and when I left, we were doing 1.4 million. Right. And when you can raise the scale of efficiency, mm-hmm. especially around payroll, because payroll and overhead is two-thirds of the revenue, all of a sudden, instead of being 60 or 65% of revenue, if you can bring that down to 50%, then you can increase the food cost, and that's where you get that other 20 or 25 cents, and that can really make a difference. So
absolutely.
We really need to raise participation, which means we need marketing, which means we need hands-on experiential learning and cooking and gardening classes. We need farm-to-school programs. We really need to get kids to actually eat the food, and that's one of the challenges we face.
I think that's the biggest challenge, actually, is to wean children away from the salt, the fat, and the sugar, which is what we're all sort of hardwired to love, and towards something that's... something that's a little, a little better for you. The distribution issue, I think, is probably going to be the hardest nut to crack, just as it is in terms of lowering our food costs overall, if we want to really use local farmers and local produce, because I think they are the least served by distribution systems and need the most help in terms of making their products available to a wider market. And
it almost seems like a city harvest. Like there need to be 20, 30 trucks going around,
yeah,
but maybe
absolutely.
The farms
it's
or the state.
It's building the regional network.
Yeah, give us your throw-out material and we'll pay you by the pound, no matter what it is,
Yeah. Do you find that to be true, Anne, that the distribution of it is really becoming the biggest challenge for you, or is it really just raising the participation and therefore raising the money? Because I know Bill said that when he started his program last year or 2 years ago in New York, they doubled their, within a couple of weeks, they doubled the participation in the school lunch program through offering better food.
I think it's all of those issues. I think with any big chains, it's sort of the chicken and the egg. How do you grow participation and grow supply side at the same time? So we really have to work at that. What we found in the school districts we've gone into is you can work on both of those things at the same time. You can really start to grow your supply chains, and that doesn't mean that individual farmers are going to, my school district here is 50 schools, 30,000 kids. It doesn't mean that a farmer is going to be able to supply me with all of one product that I need, and that the farmer should actually take their time to deliver. But then you work with regional suppliers and say, okay, I'll buy from you, but here's the farmers I want you to buy from, and I want you to act as that transportation agent. And that's another way that nutrition services directors can do what chefs have always done. And, this comes from my background as a chef, and that is, how do we get the stuff? How do we work together?
Is that allowed, though, in your line of work? With the restaurant, it's very different than with the school. I mean, as long as they have the proper insurance, you can source from them if you want?
Yeah, school. There's no laws around schools sourcing from anyone they want to source from.
Interesting.
There's no laws. A lot of people say you can't, but there's absolutely no laws. And there was some laws around geographic preference, but they were changed in the last farm bill. So those laws are moot now as well.
And one last question, and then I suspect we're going to have to go.
Well, no, we're actually going till 35,
we're going to 35.
So
okay.
We have 8 minutes.
Oh, good. So we have more time. And
Anne, by the way, we've got you a little gift. It's a platinum hairnet. As the kitchen lady. So you have to come to Roberta's and be on Radio Live
right.
to collect it.
Yeah. Next time you're in New York, I do hope
I'm
you will
I'm in New York
come.
A lot, so I'll be
Great.
Back in a couple of weeks.
And I wanted to ask you one more thing about how open to working regionally do you find the big distribution companies like Sysco, which I know supplies a lot of industrial food production and certainly schools and hotels and stuff like that. Sysco, U.S. Food, those kind of guys. Because for a while when the fuel prices went way up, they were all about doing the regional thing. And I'm wondering how
it's
much
funny
they're
how an
putting
emergency
their,
needs to get
yeah,
them to think that
I'm,
way.
I'm wondering how much they're still talking that talk as opposed to walking that walk. So, are you able to work with them on this?
Well, we actually buy from U.S. Foods here in Boulder, but we don't buy produce or anything from them. Mm. So we buy our produce from a regional produce company, and we work with them and talk to them about when we went out to bid. For a regional produce company, part of the bid, and we put it right in the RFP, is how much are you willing to work with regional farmers and how much are you willing to buy from farmers that we find that you may not be working with now. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing a nutrition services director can do. I mean, we have tremendous power. School lunch is feeding 5.4 billion lunches a year. That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
And so if we all get together and say, hey, we don't want this junk, we want something else, and you're willing to work outside of the system, then you can make it happen. But with the really big guys, I don't know. But from a produce standpoint, and actually even other products, meat, animal protein, you can often find regional distributors who are willing to help you move that product around.
So this is so fascinating. So, I mean, I want to ask about the Obamas and Michelle and if you've had any interaction with her. But before that, can you give us a week in the life? I mean, you know, the headlines of what you do in a week in your job, because it's such an interesting job, and it's really penetrating so deeply into the core of the problem in the three cities, and I'm sure is a model that can be replicated other places. What do you do? Where is your time? Are you in the kitchens teaching portioning costs? Or are you out with the farmers trying to convince them? Are you in D.C.? Where are you?
Yes. All of the above. Yes. we actually do extensive training. I am every day that I'm actually in the district, I'm in a school. I never miss a day out in a school, serving lunch, talking to kids, talking about how we're cooking the food, tasting the food. So, and I have 50 schools. I have three other chefs that are working with me and five managers. So between the nine of us, we're out in, we see every school every two or three days. And so we're in those schools. Wow. I actually am working with my business partner, Beth Collins, on procurement, and we work together to make sure that we're, you know, getting the best product we can from the most regional procurement system that we can. So we're actively doing that. I mean, I have people call me all the time and go, can we get our product in? What would it take? So I do a lot of that. I do a lot of human resources. You know, these kind of changes can be difficult, so I spend a lot of my time on human resources and a lot of time on number crunching, because we need to make this financially viable. So I spend a lot of time looking at the numbers, thinking about the numbers, looking at ways we can save money and reallocate funds so that we spend more money overall on food and less money overall on payroll. So we spend a lot of time doing that. And then, you know, just regular managerial stuff. But I'm also spending, you know, one or two days a week traveling, working on, you know, the behind the scenes, trying to see if we can change policy. This week I'm in Oklahoma, next week I'm back in D.C., the following week I'm back in New York. So I'm spending a lot of time trying to work on these issues.
I actually had a very historic lunch lady named Thelma, and whenever you would go for seconds, she would get so pissed off that she would throw the seconds at you, like if it was a patty. So you would always have to like do a little bit of exercise to catch it, and I thought that would be a way of combating maybe the obesity problem, at least in that school. But I think she's retired, unfortunately. But I loved Thelma, and it was like such the part of the day that you loved the most. And we would talk to her and try to convince her of what we wanted on the menu next week. You know, it's a real big part of the school mythology. But what about policy are you going to change? I mean, who are your allies? And I mean, what are your goals?
Yeah,
I mean,
who should we be voting for?
If there's two Obama,
on the regional levels.
If there's two Obama administrations, I mean, what do the, you know, Slow Food members out there want to be saying? Like, what are they really rooting for on a policy level?
So for me, my policy level is an extra dollar for dedicated to fresh foods, vegetables, whole grains, and regional procurement, raising the guidelines so chicken nuggets and tater tots on a reimbursable meal, mm-hmm. dedicating money to at least regional cooking kitchens, dedicating money to a national training program, and additionally to dedicate money to something I'm calling the Culinary Corps. In the same way as we have AmeriCorps or Vista, we're graduating as a nation 30,000 culinary students a year, and in this economy, there's no restaurants for them to go to, or not many. So I'd like to see, and the Secretary of Education, I think, is interested in this, I'd like to see tuition or loan reimbursement on a year-to-year basis. So if you go to a two-year culinary school, you get a certain percentage of that tuition reimbursement if you go and work in a school for those 2 years. I also think we need funding for farm-to-school, cooking and gardening classes, and a national marketing campaign. In the same way we marketed people not to, especially children, not to smoke cigarettes, we need the same kind of marketing campaign around healthy food. So those are the things. I think that we have some allies. Harkin and Leahy are really allies. Hillary Clinton's certainly been one, although she's working nationally now. I think I'm very optimistic, both with Obama, President Obama, and Michelle Obama. They really seem to get these issues. And I actually, after meeting with Matt Yale from Arnie Duncan's staff and Kathleen Merrigan, I really believe there's a lot of support to make these changes. I will say that if all of the listeners here really care about these issues, what we need to do is write Tom Vilsack and Kathleen Merrigan and say, we want better food for our kids. We really care about this. We want a dollar allocated. And because the squeaky wheel really does get oiled. And
it's you got to be squeaky. Who was telling me about Bill Clinton? He's like, he once went to one of his favorite people. He's like, if you had been a more pain in my ass, I would have been able to shepherd all of these issues, but you didn't make me have to deal with you. It's about being that squeaky wheel, you know? I mean, and really being a pain in the butt until change happens.
Well, I think Anne has done a great job of
being a pain in the butt.
No, well, being a pain in the butt to the school system, absolutely. And it's taken you 10 years to get where you are now, which is finally achieving the national recognition and prominence that your ideas and your efforts deserve. And, you know, it's too bad that we've gotten to the point where it's taken a national crisis in health and obesity in children to make people really sit up and listen to your message.
And did you read Michael Pollan's piece about how, you know, what really they should be talking about is, you know, the op-ed piece he wrote 2 weeks ago?
Like, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, did you like that? Did you
absolutely
think?
I thought it was really great, and in fact I wrote him right afterwards. Michael and I are friends, and I wrote him right afterwards and said, I can't believe it, thank you for mentioning school lunch four times.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
So it was really great. Yeah,
well, and I think we have to go, unfortunately.
Will
I
you come back and
will,
pick up your hairnet? Yeah.
Absolutely. I will come back and pick up my hairnet, and I'd be happy to be on the show anytime you invite me.
That would be great, Anne. Thank you so much for your participation today. It's been a pleasure.
Go school lunch lady.
Go look at Anne's website, The Renegade Lunch Lady. Check out thelunchbox.org. And thanks again,
I would
again,
eat
Anne.
Chicken a la King from Vancouver.
Yay.
Okay, we'll be back in a minute or two with Andy Smith, the author of Eating History. Thank you.
Sunday, it's the main course.
It's the main course, and this is Katie Kiefer with
Patrick Martins, and we're sponsored by
Hearst Ranch.
All grass-fed. I mean, just yet another plug for Hearst earlier. I mean, they were given their
burger meat
to schools at a price lower than they needed to or could have. I mean, they're really leading the way. The Hearst Ranch.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's also part of the largest land easement in the state of California.
That's right. They have 150,000 acres of ranch grasslands for their cattle and to protect the California coastline.
Exactly, and to protect all those species that rely on acreage.
Yeah, you know? That's a lot of land, 150,000.
That's where the California condor was let loose. They were like, thanks to Steve Hearst and family.
That's right. Well, thank you, Steve Hearst, for supporting the Heritage Radio Network.
Well, this is... actually, absolutely my favorite conceivable topic coming up now, which is
absolutely
broad
brushstrokes.
Don't
you have a degree in food history, Patrick?
Yeah, but mine wasn't so much. Mine was the top 30 between 1400 or 1300 and 1500.
Oh, so we can go
England and France.
How fabulous!
And I even chose England and France because it was inherently cut off by the mountains, so it was like a century or two removed from Italy or some of the more southern regions of Europe. So yeah, it was real backward up there, but fascinating too. And I love the backwardness of it. Just like I like medieval paintings where they don't quite understand depth yet.
Yeah,
you know, but you love it.
So do you actually study food history in that period?
I graduated from the performance studies department at the Tisch School at NYU. And Barbara Kirschenbach Gimblett, I actually stayed a whole extra semester. They were like, you're done, go. And I was like,
no, not me.
I am paying one more semester to take PKG's food class because she had been on sabbatical. And I mean, that food class, thank God I had stayed, because then a month after it, I met Carlo Petrini, who I would have had nothing to talk about if it wasn't for that food class, Rabelais and all that, and that led to Slow Food and Heritage and the network.
So. Amazing, amazing. Well, we have in the studio today with us Andrew F. Smith, the author of Eating History, 30 Turning Points in the Making of American Cuisine. This is one of many, many books that Andy has published. You are the most prolific author I know. And Andrew is also a professor at the New School for Social Research, where I met him because I took his class last semester. Hmm.
And you were wonderful.
Oh, thanks, Andy. Shucks. So Eating History, which is a new book. It's published by the Columbia University Press. It's a really, really pretty book. But what it is sort of an overview of how food has evolved in the United States over the last, say, 140 years.
Is that where you start, 140 years ago?
200 and...
Oh, of course, because you go all the way back to the 18th century.
1794. Yeah.
Right, right. My
Katie,
mistake.
That's your... back when you were a kid. I'm surprised you...
I was there, too.
No. I said to Andy, we are going to be the only two people in this area with no ink and no piercings.
I'm like, could you pick up at 1995 when most of our listeners just
were born,
to come into cognizance?
Well, the question I asked was, why did we eat the food in 1995, and how did we get here? And I excluded lots of food history that would typically have been there in the colonial period because it has no relevance to 1995. So I really tried to say, what are those things that happened in the past that affect us today?
That really affected what we had. I haven't finished the book, reading it sort of cover to cover, but I've leafed through the whole thing, and there are a few sort of key things that happened in the last... really since the Civil War that have had this enormous impact on the way food has started to move around the country, that the way we buy it, what we stock our kitchens with, and so forth. And the first one was the canning revolution, which really sort of started with, I guess, Borden with canning milk, or was it before that when they were canning vegetables?
What number is this, by the way, of the 30? Or is it chronological like that? I mean, is this like the 15th?
It is more or less chronological.
I think this is number five. This
number
is five.
Right? Number five.
Well, we've got, moving along here. We got a lot to do.
Well, there's so much there. I mean, every single one of these topics.
So tell us, canning was a big thing?
Well, canning was huge.
Canning existed before this, but it was all done by hand. I mean, you had to have a piece of tin, and you cut it out, and then you soldered it together.
They used to call it?
Well, putting up you could do in glass, and you could do it in your home, but this was a manufactured product. It was a very expensive product. It was only for the elite so that they could eat tomatoes in January.
Uh-huh. Yeah, except that they often died from it.
Well, that was part of the part of the excitement about eating canned food then and now.
People still eat blowfish now. They go and spend $9,000 on it.
But that's what it was. It was an elite food, or it was a food for people going on long sailing trips. So.
And so when it really got a big boost during the Civil War, when
the Union Army
the
Union Army had a problem. It had to, how do you feed a million people that may not have any food available in the local area particularly during the wintertime? And so they began saying, well, we can't get milk in the South, so let's fund Gail Borden, let's buy from Gail Borden canned condensed milk. And so that was
Who
one
was
of the first.
He was just a guy up he north?
He was an inventor from the South. I mean, this is the fascinating story. Well, he was in Texas, and he had this really great idea to make condensed meat.
And
he put
first
these meat patties together, and nobody wanted to buy the hard condensed meat, and so he lost a fortune in money. But he came to New York. He said, I got another idea.
He had endless ideas. And found people to fund them.
And found lot because he had no money himself. He found other people to fund the idea.
The U.S. government, he's pretty good funder.
Well, he never had the U.S. government until the Civil War came along. Right. But he was in the right place at the right time. He had just opened up a factory near New York. There was just a huge milk scare here. Mm-hmm. I mean, one-fourth of the kids in New York died of tuberculosis before the age of five due to the milk being served that was supposedly pure. So he came along and said, I have pure milk, and indeed it was. And so it became a nice hit just before the war. And then the Union Army came in and said, okay, fine, we need a lot more of this. And then when that worked, then they did this. So after the war, soldiers who had never tasted canned food in their lives came back and said, this was a pretty good idea. We'd like some of that ourselves. And the price dropped dramatically as you had automation coming in. So it was
one of your top 30 because... Yeah. You could conserve things longer than you could have previously, and the price came way down.
Right. You either ate fresh tomatoes in the time that it was available, or you canned the food in either home or in a commercial process.
And I'm sure there was a bunch of just nutritional reasons why this was important. I mean, people that lived in poor places, they could eat peas and get certain nutrients.
Despite what we may think of canned food today and all the other things that are in here, it did provide a huge resource for Americans that could not have afforded or had available foods during the times.
Yeah, if you think of the urban poor, they would have no access to fresh fruits or vegetables before canning became cheap enough for them to also procure it in their local regions or marketplaces.
I mean, Alice Waters, I remember being surprised. I forget what exactly she said, but something like frozen peas was a godsend, like bird's eye frozen peas. I mean, kept people alive.
That's another chapter in the book.
But that's exactly right. Your number one choice on a quality food is obviously fresh, but your number two choice, if you don't have that quality choice,
is vitamin B, C, or D getting that vitamin
in
there.
It's the frozen food.
Yeah.
And so whether you like frozen food or not, I can't argue that, but I can say that it provided tremendous vitamins and nutrition for people during the time in which fresh foods were not available.
Absolutely.
And if you think back to the interview we just conducted with Ann Cooper when we were talking about the genesis of school lunch and the fact that during World War II, when they were recruiting or conscripting, and they found that so many people were nutritionally challenged, there's the argument right there for how canned foods really played into increasing the health and vitality of our population overall. I mean, okay, not everybody was getting them, but enough people were getting the nutrition that they needed.
All wars play an important part in what people eat. And in this case, canned food was a very important product for the U.S. military during the war. But at this point, what was not a part of the military was the frozen food. And so frozen food, because there's no cans available on the open market during the war because of rationing of metal, you had frozen food that came and that didn't have metal. So you had a whole new industry that was spawned
that was the refrigeration revolution, which was another, another chapter there, and I think that's another thing that has contributed enormously to the birth of indoor refrigeration? No, it was the birth of refrigerated train cars, which would allow things like meat to come from the stockyards in Chicago to the New York marketplace, just as an example of one product.
Well, you could begin, you specialized in the country, you moved away from local food and you moved into regional food or local places that had particular food that shipped them throughout the United States. So California and Florida became oranges and fruit, one sort or another, and produce.
So what drove that? A desire for fresher food, a desire to taste exotic things like oranges? Like, was it about nutrition? Like, why all of a sudden did people decide it was important to ship meat from Chicago?
You start with the oranges and the lemons, for instance. The oranges and lemons, they discovered vitamin C about 1920 is when it became popular. It was where people were aware of it prior to that time. And they associated lemons and oranges with vitamin C. So the industry got together and said, this this is the most important thing that you can have for breakfast. Mm-hmm. This is the most important thing that you can eat. And so the
and
sales...
And the most important thing to give to your child.
The sales skyrocketed. Mm-hmm. So you had a huge... In the 1920s and the 1930s, because it was health and nutritional, and it was for children. That's exactly right. It was to help your children so that they would have the right vitamins. So it was a nutritional thing.
When my mother was a little girl, I remember her telling me a story about how her father... She was born in 1923, and when she was about five... so that would be 28 before the crash. My grandfather took her and her sister out to a drugstore in order to get a glass of fresh squeezed orange juice because it was a tremendous treat.
I'm drinking orange juice right now.
We are.
With a little champagne in it.
Yeah, I was going to say something else is in this.
But that was, and then when I grew up, my mother squeezed orange juice for five people every single morning of my childhood. It was just, she was indoctrinated with the idea that
can
orange
you imagine
juice
how
was,
exciting that taste must have been?
It was fantastic. Yeah. A whole lug of, my father bought a whole lug of oranges, and every day the fresh squeezed orange juice would be part of our breakfast. And
well,
I thought
tell me about...
You grew up in the Midwest, right?
I grew up in California.
Oh, in California. Yeah. I didn't realize that.
One of my epiphanies taste-wise, I hate to admit it, is being 6'4", 5'6", and tasting, I believe, Sunkist and Dr. Pepper. I mean, I could have been, you know, my dog could have just passed away and I would taste a Sunkist. And for that minute, the world was good and happy. Was that one of your top 30, like sodas and kind of...
I was hoping you'd ask. Originally, I tried to do 15 turning points and mm-hmm. I thought I'd keep it limited. And then I started thinking about, oh, no, you can't do 15. You need to put 20 down there. Yeah. So I wrote a proposal with 20. I sent it off to Columbia University Press and they sent it out to reviewers. And we said, oh, you can't do this without this and without this. And they were right. So I upped it to 25. Mm-hmm. And then when I started writing it, I said, well, if you do this, you can't do this.
Right.
And so I ended up with 32. And Columbia University Press didn't like the number 32.
That was very arbitrary, sounds
good. 32 doesn't. So I said, not a problem.
You added Twinkie to the soda chapter?
No, I removed the soda chapter and I removed the fruit juice chapter and I actually removed another chapter on milk and said, what we need is a sequel to this called Drinking History, and that's what I'm writing now.
Oh, good for you. That's great.
And, okay, so sodas and the kind of pop food, like...
Soda has a tremendous influence. Whether you like them or not, that's not my choice. My choice of putting in or saying they have a tremendous influence on Americans.
They've had a huge impact. I mean, nowadays, everybody is saying that sodas are one of the leading contributing causes to obesity in children and adults.
Top 30, like, the first, you know, scientists in a lab room... producing something because they knew kids would love it. I mean, when did that kind of move happen where it became science food or, you know, the Fruit Loops, the high fructose? I mean, when did that kind of catering to young kids?
Well, there's a chapter on snack food. When does that begin? And snack food, of course, in the 19th century would have been a no-no. You mm-hmm. didn't eat between meals, which is what my grandmother told
me. Well, it wasn't until the World's Fair or something when the German brothers who created Cracker Jacks. Wasn't that one of the very first snack foods?
Well, I use Cracker Jack as a representative for a whole series of things. It's the first national snack food, and it's not scientists at all. It's really local entrepreneurs who are, in this case, street vendors who come up with a good idea and say, wow, this is such a great idea. Why don't we expand beyond Chicago, where they started off? And they just began a national advertising campaign to promote it.
And then you get sound effect E.
I'm not getting sound. But that's exactly... It's exactly what happens. Through advertising, snack foods go national. And when Cracker Jack succeeds, then you have a whole series of other ones coming along. So it's only when you have these established then by local people sitting down and saying, this is a great idea, that they become corporations. And corporations say, we got a good product.
I love how Ann mentioned marketing. You know, you can't be so higher than thou that you forget that you got to sell it.
You have to sell it. Actually, let's take a second here to talk to Andy about marketing, because in a way, marketing and advertising, which we spent a lot of time talking about in your class, has had as much to do with the rise of industrialized food as almost any development in terms of the science and the technology of it. Was it Campbell's that started really labeling their soups and making sort of attractive labels?
Well, the problem with canned food was you couldn't see inside. With a glass jar, you can look in and see, you can see whether it looks good or not, but when you have a tin can there, you can't do that. So they really began advertising putting types of things that should appear in the can, so that when you bought the canned food, you would think that you were drinking or eating the food that was there.
That's right. So you were getting carrots and onions.
So you're getting carrots
or
tomatoes, and they would, of course,
like
be luscious looking, and all the other things.
And then they would have the chubby cheeked Campbell's Kids.
And later on, Campbell's Kids comes in. But the real advertising starts off with Quaker Oats. And here's a food that no real American would eat.
Well, nobody ate it. It was animal food.
It's animal food. I mean, oats were commonly grown here, but they were given to animals.
Well, my sister still feeds her horse oats.
Well, I'm not a horse, but I like oats too. But in any case, they had a problem. How do you promote oats? How do you promote, in this case, Quaker Oats as a product to the broad public? And at the time when they began doing their advertising in the late 19th century, normally you had to sell to each local grocery store, and there were 50,000 local grocery stores in America, and impossible to hit. So their goal was to hit the customer and have the customer demand Quaker Oats from the local grocery store. So they went a different direction, and it was very successful.
Can you tell me about the first one and two or three, you know, the very first three turning points in American food history, the way you see it?
I did. The one that interested me when the first one is a man by the name of Oliver Evans, who takes a look at milling in America and says, there's four people running a grist mill, and I can make it so that with pulleys and with elevators and with all sorts of, with buckets, I can make it totally automatic. And this is what he does in 1794.
So he goes from four people to one person.
To zero people.
Oh, zero.
In theory, zero. Of course, some need somebody to fix it, and need somebody to cart it away at the end.
Right,
but
right.
Technically, you just move up your cart, the buckets come down, and all the rest of it is done automatically.
You load your grain in, and it mills it into flour.
And that's the beginning of continuous processing, which is basically the core of every single processed food in America today. So.
And tell me about one of my favorite historical figures, Laura Ingalls Wilder, and all the documentation she did. What was happening in 1860? Do you have any turning points right during that critical period?
Well, that's the Civil War. So I've got I have one chapter on the Civil War, but I have a whole, there's actually four that deal with that, because again, the Civil War creates modern America, whether
warfare, even. It's, they say, warfare. It was the first modern war.
Everything you can think of that happened during World War I and World War II, including flying machines, including trench warfare, all that begins in the Civil War. Mm-hmm. But also, it's food. It's the same thing. How do you feed people, and how do you use food as a weapon? And food was used as a weapon during the war.
And they blockaded the South.
Not just a blockade, it was literally an attempt by the North to say, where's the breadbasket of the South, and let's grab it. And that, in my opinion, was one of the major reasons on why the war ended. There was no reason on why the South should have lost from a military standpoint.
Huh. Fascinating. And but now, they lost their supply of food.
That's correct.
And they buckled.
They cracked.
As they had to.
They cracked. Is there a return now to older ways?
I have a number of new things, Alice Waters being one.
Well, she's on your list of topics
down there. And she obviously creates an alternative to the system that was there. And also organic food. And I liked Jerome Rodale. And he really, you know, created the organic movement.
And that was like in the 40s, right?
Well, he started there's no good time to start a magazine. But when organic gardening started, it was the perfect time. It was during World War II, and in the midst of this, everyone was encouraged to have farms, to have produce gardens.
Right,
their own,
the victory garden.
To carve up your lawn, put in a vegetable garden, and they didn't have any manure, fertilizer, chemical fertilizers, and so he really began this organic movement that started and was very successful during the war, lost traction after the war, but then was picked up again in the 60s and 70s, and it started, and it's part of what we do today. So
we have nine more minutes. A couple of the other things that excuse me, I wanted to address was both the rise of ethnic foods and hamburgers.
Yeah.
Hold on, let's do a studio drop.
This is Joe Bastianich, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
Thank you, Patrick.
No problem.
So we'll take a little segue into the hamburger, because that sort of starts us off on the whole issue of fast food, which has come to dominate so much of the American food landscape.
Yep.
So now the hamburger was originally, I was just reading this morning, the Hamburg steak, and that was developed by two German brothers.
In New Haven?
No, that's a nice story.
It was probably in Chicago, right?
No, I bought that hamburger. I paid like $6 for it.
I was there too. It's a good hamburger, yeah. But not historically accurate.
Okay.
But the point is, it is German immigrants that come into America. They're trying to serve foods for other immigrants. The immigrants don't have a lot of money. And simply taking the remains of beef that comes out of steak and other chops and put them together, grind them up and put them onto a patty. And that was called a hamburger steak.
Yeah, well, part of it was the whole ethnic surge of ethnic populations into the United States.
Right.
So here, I'm just reading here. Here's the page. And of course, I didn't want to mark up my beautiful book, so I didn't actually write it down. Oh, dear. Mm-hmm. Oh,
what
here it is.
For?
Oh, a New York Times, this is in 1873. Yeah. August Ernest's New York City restaurant, for instance, served beginning in 1873 something called the Hamburg steak. So this is really an historical.
That's the first record I could find of people making ground beef in a patty and serving it in a restaurant.
A New
and
York
what
Times,
city was this?
This
New
is
York.
In New York.
In New York City.
And a New York Times article described it as, quote, simply a beefsteak redeemed from its original toughness by being mashed into mincemeat and then forced into a conglomerated mass. This is very appetizing, but conscience compels us to state that it is inferior to the genuine article, which can also be had here in a very satisfactory condition of tenderness. Over the next 20 years, Hamburg steak, as it became known, took America by storm, and by the 1890s, it had evolved into the quintessential American food, the hamburger sandwich, and was sold by street vendors in most cities.
Right.
So then the original McDonald's decided...
Was that a turning point?
Yeah, sorry.
It
fast
was
food.
A
I had to
point.
Put it in.
God, this is like...
But that's so interesting.
No.
First of all, who thought that
historical
the hamburger steak
accuracy
was around
is important.
For that long? Yeah, it is. And secondly, who could have possibly predicted that this rather humble article would turn into the incredible powerhouse?
Who could have
that it
who
has?
Could have predicted that the Germans would have been an indirect cause of ill problems?
Gee, I would hate to speculate on that. So tell us how this evolved from the pushcart into
Right. It's a low-cost food. It's relatively easy to do. As soon as you have a push cart that is able to fry up a patty then mm-hmm. and put two pieces of bread around it, you don't have knives, forks, and spoons, which you right. would have in a restaurant prior to this time. And so it becomes one of America's first fast food.
And you don't need the same ingredients every single time. And it could truly be,
it's whatever you have.
A meatloaf.
It's whatever you have. And there were lots of other ingredients in hamburger rather than just the beef. So frequently you would put onions in there, you might put garlic in there, whatever people
bread
like.
Crumbs
is TV dinners
TV dinners is another chapter.
God, this
I can't
is
help it.
I mean, what's good in this? No,
well,
it's
we'll
all
have to
important.
Give you this
no,
book to read, Patrick.
We need him to
really
do
wonderful.
A green version.
Well, he's my choice. I tried to look at it and said, what is it that people eat, and not making value judgments on whether it's good or bad. Only simply saying this is how we got here.
This is like Mr. Burns from The Simpsons. No, just kidding. I'm totally joking. I cannot wait to read this book. But tell me, so TV dinners, what did you bring up in that chapter? Is it about basically for the first time people just staring at a TV set? Or is it
well,
about
it
liberation of the woman?
I know it sounds strange, but it really didn't start that way. It started with a company in Omaha, the Swanson family that came along and said, well, you know, we have a lot of turkeys left over from the season. We got to do something with them, and we can only make so many chicken pot pies and turkey pot pies.
No,
you had this ton of they really had a lot of turkeys left over. They said, what can we do with it? And so one of the things said, well, rather than just freeze the turkey and try to resell it in the spring, why don't we come along and try and put it into a meal format, which was a typical thing served on airlines like TWA when you went to Europe at the time. So they took an idea that was there, took aluminum, which was low cost, and they put it together. And they shaped the box like a TV, not because they expected people to sit down and eat it in front of a TV, but because they thought this was the new technology in 1953 and something that was exciting to Americans. Little did they realize that Americans concluded that because this was a TV dinner, that it meant that you could eat in front of a TV.
You could and should.
And that does change Americans. Prior to this time, many American families, not all, had family dinners in which you would sit down at a table, you would have the same food that your mother would prepare, and my family, you either ate it or you didn't. If you didn't eat it, then that was it.
Chuck wagon was closed, man.
In this case, you could have whatever TV dinner that you wanted. So if you wanted turkey, you could get that. If you wanted chicken, you could get that. If you wanted beef, you could get that. And you didn't have to sit around a table. You could actually take a TV tray, which comes out of the TV dinner, and watch TV, which was a new technology at the time.
Well, this has been what a fascinating interview. I mean, I hope now that I know that you live in Brooklyn, you know, we're going to be asking you back for sure.
Oh, we're going to have you back.
I'll be back.
Not even on this show, but I mean, you know, I think he should do his own show. Don't you think that, Jack?
Yes.
Jack, we have a producer mic.
Book it.
Okay, Jack. What day do you want me here?
All right. Well, you like the place, right? We are here
it.
For
it's
people
great.
Who can't see. We are overlooking a restaurant. There's two people, by the way, the entire time I was here, they're sitting out there, have been grooming each other. It's like monkeys out there. They've been like going through each other's hair. It was very awkward.
How but adorable.
Now we have a bunch of hipsters coming in, choosing their shade. Anyway, it's a beautiful place. Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. That's 261 Moore Street. L train to Morgan
Avenue stop on the L train. That's right.
Yeah, Patrick, I appreciate the interview, but I'm really here for the pizza.
The pizza, yeah, of course.
Really?
Well, we have one waiting
we
for us.
We got one waiting for us.
So this is, we've been brought to you by Hearst Ranch.
This is the main course with Patrick Martin's Katie Kiefer. Thank you to our guests, Andy Smith and Ann Cooper.
Engineer Nat Wiener.
Engineered by Nat Wiener and produced by Jack Inslee. See you next week, folks.